case. And Mr. Lentz, it looks like you've entered into the same agreement that Ms. Cruz did. You know, you saw how well that looked, or that worked.
Yes, Your Honor. I appreciate it. May I reserve 3 minutes, Your Honor?
3 minutes, yes, sir. Mr. Chief
Judge, may it please the Court, Trevor Cox again from the Attorney General's Office. We filed a similar brief in this case as we did in the Canales case, limited to the same two issues. I'd like to make just a few additional points specific to this case. First, here it's even clearer that Mr. Hurd's client does not dispute that the code authorizes courts to make SIJ findings. He made that concession on page 14 of his brief. Second, even more clearly than in Canales, the circuit court here explained that it was refusing to make SIJ findings because it didn't believe that they were appropriate where the child was already living with the parent. We believe that's an
Let me stop you right there. Assuming Mr. Hurd's concession, I'm not doubting that concession has been made. Since that concession could be interpreted as a determination or concession of law, we're not necessarily bound by that concession, are we?
That's correct, Your Honor. But what we would say about the circuit court's decision below that the rules of the SIJ scheme are clearly designed for circumstances not presented in this case, as where a child ended up in the care of the state or someone who's not the child's natural parent. That's at appendix page 40. That's an erroneous interpretation of the law. One parent SIJ findings are not unusual and are accepted by USCIS. And in any event, that's...
Mr. Cox, and I don't want to take up too much time. I take it that the Attorney General has no position regarding the specifics of whether we have sufficient notice to reach the merits in this case.
That's correct, Your Honor. We do not
then
take
I would like to ask you a general notice question, yes. Not to the specifics in this case. In general, does the Attorney General agree that before a court may determine a parent's rights in a custody proceeding, some form of notice or service of process must be had, whether substitute or otherwise?
I believe the code provides for that, yes.
Thank you.
So what the circuit court did was make an immigration decision that was properly left to the immigration officials. And that's what we've tried to set forth in our brief. It is possible for juvenile courts to comply with the scheme without intruding on federal immigration officials' discretion. Third, the circuit court was wrong to refuse to make the SIJ finding that it is in the best interest of the child not to return to the parent's native country. At appendix page 41.
Assuming we're able to get to the merits of the case and overcome what may be perceived as a notice problem, do you believe that in this case there is a factual predicate for making the determination or for assessing that the SIJ determinations have been made?
We don't take a position on that, Your Honor. Our position is limited to what the proper legal framework should be and that we encourage this court to adopt. Because this is a question that has come up a number of times.
What would you propose as the remedy in this case?
We would propose that if the court chooses to hear the merits and remands it, that it instructs the lower court about the proper legal framework that it should use.
And that proper legal framework is?
Well, as set forth in our brief, we believe that it's possible for the juvenile courts to make these findings without treading on federal immigration officials' discretion.
Possible, but not required.
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
You keep using permissive words, not required words. Possible, but not required for the court to make such findings?
We think that this court should instruct the lower court that it does have the power to make those findings.
But is not required to.
Our position is that if a petitioner asks for those findings, and they're so consistently overlapping with the factors that a court shall consider, that the court should decide those questions, either yes or no.
Mr. Cox, the last case, I kind of asked you a number of questions regarding the first subsection of 8 U.S.C. 1446. Let me ask you about the second subsection, which refers to a finding that it is not in the child's best interest to be returned to their native country, and that finding has to take place in, quote, judicial or administrative proceedings. I think the question really is, given that Congress clearly in the first subsection used the word state as a modifier for what state courts do there, but did not do so with respect to the second subsection. I guess one of my questions would simply be, in terms of statutory construction, it seems to me, given that the second subsection actually, in terms of legislative history, actually predates the first subsection, whether administrative or judicial refers to federal administrative judicial proceedings or state judicial or administrative proceedings. Clearly, I think a juvenile court or a circuit court on appeal has the expertise to determine whether it's in the child's best interest to be returned to a parent or grandparent or family member, but I wonder at the expertise a state court would have regarding whether a particular country is in the best interest for a child to be returned to. Unless we're going to say, you know, America is the greatest country on earth, and by definition, everybody, you know, this is always going to be a better opportunity for a juvenile, then it seems to me state courts lack a lot of expertise that federal officials and the Department of State and the Department of Homeland Security might be better able to advise federal officials, immigration judges, for example, administrative judges who sit in immigration courts. So what's the Attorney General's view of how we interpret that subsection?
What I would say is that it may be that federal immigration officials have a better idea of what the situation is like in different countries, but what a juvenile court is asked to do is to compare two living situations, one here and the one that they were in before. The USCIS, in their policy manual, says, and I'll quote, "A best interest determination generally involves the deliberation that courts undertake under state law when deciding what types of services, actions, and orders will best serve a child, as well as the deliberation regarding who is best suited to take care of a child." And the Maryland Court of Special Appeals in 2015, in summarizing that, says the best interest inquiry is a straightforward comparison between two living situations. We give a few examples in our brief of what other state courts have done.
I think common sense would suggest that if a state court makes a finding in, as part of a judgment, that it is not in the child's best interest to be returned to a parent in Guatemala or Honduras or wherever, that a natural, in the absence of any other information to the contrary, where you have the other parent who's a permanent resident or a citizen of this country, the only rational conclusion would be it would be in the child's best interest to remain with the parent who happens to reside here. But is it the state court or the Department of Homeland Security through its mechanisms, or a federal district court through its mechanisms, that makes that determination?
Well, I think they both do, but initially starts with the juvenile court, and they are asked to make the same kind of judgments that they always make about what the living situation is going to be better in terms of health care and education and opportunities and a supportive family environment. And so juvenile courts can do that without encroaching on federal immigration officials' discretion.
So if I hypothetically could a juvenile court, let's say, determine that a child should be not returned to their native country solely because of the political environment there. In other words, could a juvenile court apply purely political evaluation to the child's best interest as opposed to, for example, hypothetically, if there's a solid family foundation in the native country and it just happens that the father is someone that the court has determined should not participate in the child's life any further, is it the juvenile court's determination, role to determine, I should say, whether or not that particular country as a whole, given all the other things that are going on outside of what its normal expertise would be with respect to family foundations, educational opportunities, social service opportunities, things of that nature, is that the proper role of the state court?
I don't think that state courts would look at politics writ large.
But they could. The statute, that subsection is pretty broad. Doesn't say just child's best interest. It says child's best interest with respect to being returned to their native country.
Right. In the specific of that child's living environment, the potential there, I think it would have to be focused on that particular child.
Right.
But because they're such confusing, we encourage this court to adopt an appropriate legal framework in a conservative way, the way the New Jersey Supreme Court did in HSP versus JK, which I would commend to your attention. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Cox. Mr. Lentz?
As you're getting situated, we're going to go ahead and let the bear out of the room. How do you deal with the notice issues that are raised by your opponent colleague?
Your Honor, we deal with them by turning to page 21 of the appendix.
where the juvenile domestic relations or decree states, legal notice has been given to all proper and necessary parties. It states that legal notice has been given. Under Moore v. Holt, we do not look behind that. But even if we did, on appendix page 20, you have the district deputy clerk's certification that legal notice had been mailed to the father, had been posted at the courthouse, and had been provided to the newspaper for publication.
To what address was it mailed, given that your client steadfastly maintained that she did not know what his address was? That seems to me to be an impossibility.
Your Honor, two answers. First, that is not in the record, which is why Moore v. Holt says we do not go behind the court's finding.
The affidavit is in the record where she checks that she does not know the last known address.
The affidavit is, but on the petition, at page 1, it provides an address for father in, and I apologize for the pronunciation.
So the affidavit was false?
It provides an address, which is the same information provided on the affidavit, but if you look on page 1 under section 15 of the petition, it says that father's date of birth and father's phone number are unknown, but it does not say father's address is unknown, and it does provide an address on line 6. So my best guess, looking behind the JDR certification that notice was provided, is that it was mailed to the address on line 6 of appendix 1.
Was it met under the Uniform Juvenile Service Statute that you reference in your reply brief? My question is, was it mailed certified, mail return receipt requested? Is there any evidence of that in the record?
Whether the mailing was conducted through certified mail, no, there's not evidence of that, other than the JDR statement that legal notice was provided to all necessary parties.
Is that a legal finding or a factual finding?
I believe it is a factual finding under Moore v. Holt, which as we...
If it's a factual finding, the record has to support that factual finding. So where do we find in the record the support for the factual finding that proper notice was given and principal jurisdiction applied?
On appendix page 20 from the deputy clerk's certification that it was mailed, posted, and provided to the newspaper. That is the factual support.
If that is not sufficient, let's just assume for the purpose of my question that is not. How is it sufficient notice before the circuit court if the number of days was less than the required number?
If the JDR notice was not sufficient, there was not sufficient notice provided before the circuit court. However, in that situation, the remedy is still reversal, because that would mean that the order below and the findings below are annulled. So we can't simply dismiss the appeal. The result is the same, notice or not. It is reversal.
Well, except it's the difference between reversal and vacatur and reversal and remand, is it not?
No, Your Honor, because if there's no notice, it would be reversal with instructions to provide notice.
Or to vacate the order that had been entered.
To vacate the order that had been entered, and at that point, mother could provide notice at that point. So in both situations...
Well, no, if there's no notice, there's no personal jurisdiction, so we would basically dismiss, essentially, I mean, for lack of jurisdiction.
And at that point, there would be nothing precluding mother from filing a petition.
Well, that's true. That's correct, because there's no res judicata effect if you never had personal jurisdiction.
So it would be reversal and vacatur of the decision below, and the circuit court could decide the appropriate course, whether to continue on the present petition and allow mother to provide notice or to file the same petition the next day.
It wouldn't be vacatur of just the circuit court proceeding, it would be vacatur of everything. You wouldn't start back in the circuit court, you'd start in the JNDR court again.
Correct, Your Honor. And if I may briefly address the matters that have come up in the previous argument as well.
Realizing you're in your rebuttal time, which is okay.
Realizing I am.
Okay.
It appears all parties agree that there's jurisdiction to make a custody determination and jurisdiction to make SIJ findings within that custody proceeding. The only question is whether it is legal error or an obligation to do so. And the standard for that, when matters are permissive, is discretion. But discretion can be abused. And in an appropriate case, where the facts are clear on the record and where it might assist the child, a trial judge would abuse discretion in failing to enter the factual findings.
But you,
so
you
it is
agree it's a May. You do agree it's a May standard.
I do, Your Honor. The trial judge must consider whether to make them, but may decide not to.
Well, in your case, of course, no factual findings were ever made because the trial court said, basically, I'm not going to deal with any of this. That may have been error, but there, basically, there's all we could ever do in the light most favorable to you is remand for the purpose of the court actually considering the merits of the petition.
Well, 2 points, Your Honor. There were factual findings entered in the opinion letter. They are enumerated. But the court held it lacked...
The court can't have it both ways. It's either justiciable and this is the adjudication, or it's not justiciable and anything the court says after that is a nullity.
And if that's the view this court takes, it may ignore the factual findings and instruct that there is jurisdiction to resolve a custody petition.
Mr. Lentz, I've got a question that will get you past the triple zero, and then it's up to Chief whether you give me the phrase or not. We keep hearing the phrase best interest of the child, but that's not in the abstract, is it? It's in relation to the case that's in... The court is not to take the best interest of the child. It's to resolve the case in front of it. So in a custody situation where you have presumably one fit parent seeking custody, it's what's in the best... Placing the child in whose custody is in the child's best interest. So it's either dad or mom. That's the best interest inquiry. It's not some abstract what it would be the best possible way to raise this child writ large. It's the best interest in resolving the dispute, isn't it?
Yes, Your Honor, and briefly, the factors for SIJ almost directly correspond to the custody factors under the Virginia Code. For example, abandonment and reunification corresponds to factor 5, which is the role each parent has played abandonment and will play in the future, reunification. So the factors that the court already must consider correspond to the SIJ with respect to the individual child. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, sir. Mr. Hurd.
May it please the Court, with respect to the procedural problem in this case, I believe opposing counsel has conceded that if there was no jurisdiction, no proper notice in the J&D court, then it was not obtained in the circuit court because of the 50-day versus 42-day problem. So then let's look at whether there was jurisdiction, whether there was notice in the J&D court. There are two ways to give notice. One is by certified or registered mail, return receipt requested. There's no evidence of that anywhere in the record. There is on page 20 of the appendix a box checked by the clerk saying that things were mailed to the last known address. It doesn't say certified. It doesn't say registered. It doesn't say return receipt requested. It just says mailed to the last known address. So taking that at face value, it is deficient for mailing.
Well, we're to presume that a court has followed the legal standard, aren't we?
That box check, Your Honor, says no more than it says, and it is a form used for publication. We also mail. It's a form used for publication. It is not a form used in lieu of publication, where you're trying to take advantage of the certified mail, registered mail route.
How about the reference to what is concededly form language on page 21 of the appendix? Legal notice has been given to all proper and necessary parties. Is that a question of fact? Is it a question of law? How do we review that statement in the order?
I think you have to review that in terms of what the court was trying to do. The court was trying to serve by publication. That's very clear. There's an affidavit of publication. That's why the little box is checked. You get over into the circuit court. What the circuit court says is that there was no order of publication in this case. That's on page 25 of the appendix.
But isn't that fairly read as referring to the proceedings in the circuit court itself?
I don't believe so. Because if you don't need an order of publication in the circuit court, if you had things correctly in the J&D court, you wouldn't need to have said that. You wouldn't need to have gone out again. So clearly the court is talking about no publication in the J&D R court. And indeed, the affidavit showing that publication has occurred is nowhere to be found. The clerk says, I'll mail it to the newspaper, but we don't have the other orders or the other evidence necessary to support publication. So my client did not get even the constructive notice that the law entitles him to. The proper remedy in this case is either to dismiss the case, of course, without prejudice, or to remand the case all the way back down for the change to your court to give proper notice, constructive though it may be, to my client. If the court chooses the latter route, then, of course, the court may wish to include some instructions about how to consider these claims for SIJ issues. Now, turning to that, with respect to my supposed succession.
Counsel, I appreciate your hard work on this, and I'm just sort of sitting here noodling through my head the respective remedies that might exist in this case. And if we were to take your view, and you're arguing zealously on behalf of your client, I appreciate that. In the one case, we would have a dismissal. This case we're talking about now, we'd have a dismissal with the opportunity for that petitioner to go back to court and start again with essentially some instruction as to how you need to perfect your case, theoretically. Okay? But on the first case, because your view is that there is no record factually to support the SIJ findings, that particular case ends up being rendered res judicata, and there's no remedy left for that particular case.
Yes, Your Honor.
Is that fair?
Your Honor, it's the law.
But we do have some sense of fairness that we're supposed to accomplish in these cases, aren't we?
Your Honor, these entire proceedings have a certain element of unfairness, unavoidably so, when you have clients like mine who have no idea that their rights are even being litigated.
Well, law can be such a nuisance sometimes.
Which is why, Your Honor, I asked in the beginning that my client at least be afforded the assurance that the laws will be scrupulously applied and that no shortcuts will be taken out of sympathy for the issues here today. What really ought to happen in these cases is the General Assembly ought to consider doing what Maryland did, which is to pass legislation that specifically authorizes the making of...
But didn't the General Assembly sort of give us an indication as to maybe how they felt already? Because wasn't there legislation precluding these determinations being made and that legislation didn't catch fire?
You know, I don't think you could read anything into legislative intent about the bill that was passed and withdrawn. It's just not cognizable in terms of what it means. So, no, I don't think there's any suggestion.
I don't think any of us would dispute that had the General Assembly, of course, grants the jurisdiction of the courts of the Commonwealth, and were they to act and provide specific jurisdiction to do so, we wouldn't be having this discussion right now.
Well, that's correct. That's correct. And the fact that one legislator may have thought he wanted to take away something that he perhaps thought the courts had, and then withdrew his bill, may suggest he decided the courts did not have that authority. So you can't read anything into that bill being submitted and withdrawn one way or the other. Now, with respect to my alleged concession, what I said on page 14 of my brief was this, that when a court decides whether to award custody to a Virginia-based single parent of a foreign national, it may include some SIJ-like findings in the order, but it is under no obligation to do so, especially if they can make the decision without reaching those issues. So, yes, the court may say, oh, there was abandonment here by the father, and make that finding parallels SIJ findings.
The issue was raised earlier in the other case this morning about how federal statutes can require states to do certain things, such as in a qualified domestic relations order. If you don't use the language, then you don't get the result you want. Is there any sort of requirement in this federal statute like that?
No, Your Honor, and actually the quadro statute works a bit differently. There's no mandatory language, as I understand the federal quadro ERISA rules. There's no language mandating what a state court must do. Instead, the law operates on the ERISA plan administrator and says, plan administrator, before you divide up this pension, here's what you must have. And the federal statutory instruction to the ERISA manager preempts any order coming from the state court to the extent there's some conflict. But there's no requirement as such on state courts.
So the military quadros, or quadro isn't probably the right acronym for that, but some of those do require specific language.
But
we don't have that here.
If I understood your point, it's the administrator who requires the language, not the Congress requiring the court to include the language.
Judge Russell, that is my understanding, and I think that applies to both cases, but even if it does not, even if in the military case there is a federal statute telling state courts, do decide this, we do not have that here. We have Congress speaking in very passive language in the course of giving a definition. Immigrant President of the United States who has been declared dependent on a juvenile court. And that kind of passive voice definition falls very short of imposing an obligation.
Well, I'm not sure anybody can cite an example where Congress, through a definition, has granted jurisdiction to do anything as part of a definition.
Judge Roberts, I think that's right. And we're dealing here now with an area of the law where since 1890 at least, in Ray Burroughs' case, the U.S. Supreme Court has said that child custody decisions are entirely a matter of state law. Entirely a matter of state law. And we have Burger D. Ashcroft, which says that if Congress is going to disrupt the federal-state balance, as it would the mandated jurisdiction in a juvenile court, if Congress is going to do that, it must do so in clear and explicit terms. We have no clear and explicit terms here telling state courts to do anything. We have a passive voice definition.
Well, if the JNDR Court, Circuit Court, has the jurisdiction to reach SIJS findings in connection with a custody issue and so forth, there are some legal presumptions, aren't there? And I'm referring to the Prince versus United States case, second employer's liability cases that as I read them, stand for the proposition that if there's jurisdiction, then there's also an implied duty to exercise the jurisdiction.
No, Your Honor, it's not. So the Prince case dealt with executive power. And Prince State's case stands for the proposition that Congress may not hijack state executive authority. It does not deal with judicial authority.
Well, Justice Scalia left open the possibility, pure dicta, that might not necessarily apply to the judiciary.
It might not. And the Supreme Court of the United States has not reached that issue. Now, with respect to the kinds of cases that are cited in some of the opposing briefs, what happened there was that a state was trying to exert its own policy preference in opposition to the policy decision of Congress. And the cases say states can't do that. And they can't do that even where a state affirmatively carves out a certain kind of case and says the state court cannot decide that. Case in point was dealing with prison, 1983 cases against prison guards. State law said, our courts have no jurisdiction to entertain any cases against prison guards. Somebody brought a 1983 case against a prison guard in a state court. Courts said they have no jurisdiction. Went up the line. Courts said, well, yes, you do have jurisdiction because you cannot use a jurisdictional carve-out as a way of implementing a policy that is in opposition to federal policy. We don't have that here. We don't have anything for the General Assembly saying, you shall not make SIJ findings, or you shall not entertain applications by juveniles from other countries. We don't have any of that. We don't have a carve-out of jurisdiction. What we have is a lack of jurisdiction, except insofar as you need to make the findings in the course of making the custody finding. Now, on the abandonment part, I think that's pretty straightforward. It certainly is part of a custody determination to decide if a parent has abandoned the child. And with respect to whether it's one parent or two, I think actually the Attorney General's suggestion that the court might address both and then let federal authorities figure out what one or both means in that statute. But with respect to this business about what country is better for the child, if you make the decision that the child should be with a mother who is here in Virginia, then isn't the question of whether the child should be in Honduras or Guatemala or here, isn't that purely advisory? Of course, the court cannot tell the mother, take the child back there, the child will be better off back there, do it. The court cannot tell the mother that. On the other hand, if the court says, well, the child should be in Virginia, If the mother wants to take the child back, then the mother gets to do that. So this whole opinion about is it better for the child to be here or better for the child to be there, that's all purely advisory once you grant custody to the mother. And there is no authority to make these advisory opinions unless the General Assembly decides to do so, decides to give that authority to our juvenile courts and our circuit courts. And it may be a bad idea, but the law doesn't authorize it now.
Let me ask you this, counsel. Assuming, and again, I appreciate your argument, assuming we adopt the view that the court may have inherent authority, the lower court may have inherent authority to make these SIJ determinations congruent with a custody determination. And assume we look at a record, and the record suggests that the reason why the trial judge didn't find there was abandonment because they used the wrong standard, a clear convincing evidence standard, what would the standard be for abandonment in an SIJ case? Is it clear and convincing? Is it something else? What do you believe the standard is?
Well, the standard for abandonment, insofar as a custody decision is concerned, is I don't believe it's clear and convincing.
I agree.
It's finest evidence.
Yes.
When you get over into termination of parental rights, actual legal termination, then you've got a higher standard.
But if this court were to determine that the trial court, in sort of looking at this case as a termination case, consider the clear and convincing standard in an abandonment case, and made its determination of lack of abandonment based upon that, would that give us the authority to send the case back to the trial court to allow it to consider it under the appropriate standard on a traditional custody?
Well, you know, we would. Okay. I believe that if this trial court had said, I'm going to apply a clear and convincing evidence standard and you have failed to meet it, and therefore I'm not going to find abandonment in this custody case, I think that would be a reason to send the case back and have the trial court apply the proper preponderance standard. Of course, in this case, the court did not say that. Did not use the words clear and convincing. And that is no doubt part of the reason why that was not included in the assignments of error and why it is not discussed in those terms anywhere in opposing counsel's brief. Therefore, Your Honor, for the reason given, we ask this case be dismissed completely or be dismissed or be remanded back the Cheney Court with appropriate instructions.
Thank you, Mr. Hurd. Mr. Lentz, in an act of limited grace, we'll put 1 minute back on the clock for you.
Sorry, minute 8. Yeah, next 8 seconds out of that.
Yeah.
Yes.
Thank you very much, Your Honor. The JADR, of course, factual finding that notice was provided can only be overturned for clear error. Appendix page 20 prevents the finding of clear error with respect to that finding. So notice was provided. This case is justiciable because it affects the child's legal status. That is why the court below had jurisdiction, and it is justiciable. And therefore, this court should reverse and provide further instructions as the end of justice required.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you very much. That concludes the hearing in both cases. The court stands adjourned. Thank you.
All right.